Welcome to the Fit Vegan Body Podcast with your host, Aaron Cattell, the vegan coach. The point of this podcast is to give you an in-depth but practical approach when it comes to losing weight, being healthy, or gaining muscle on a vegan or plant-based diet. We will have guests every single week to help clear up any confusion and make sure that you are 100% confident in your choice of your lifestyle.
Hey guys, so in this episode of the Fit Vegan Podcast, I interview Dr. Renee. Dr. Renee Thompson is very interesting. She is actually a resident doctor at one of the five blue zones. The one that actually lives the longest, which has a vegan population in California, Loma Linda. She is also, or used to be, a moderator for nutritionfacts.org. So nutritionfacts.org is obviously Dr. Greger's baby. Dr. Greger wrote How Not to Die. So she is very well-practiced in knowing how to read research, knowing how to read studies, and knowing which ones actually show true causation and, of course, which ones are maybe funded or designed to get a real result as opposed to ones that are, you know, maybe a little bit more tinkered with. So over the next hour, you'll get to listen to her. We cover a lot of things, and I hope you really enjoy it. If you want to follow her, you can go to her Instagram at Dr. Renee Thompson, which you can also see in the show notes. But yeah, please share it if you enjoy this, and I will also reshare it so more and more people can kind of see and listen to the benefits of a plant-based diet. Hey guys, welcome to another podcast episode of Fit Vegan Body. I'm here with Dr. Renee Thomas. Hi, Renee. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really pleased to be here. It's super exciting. I love podcasts.
I'm super excited to have you because you work in an area that I think is super interesting. And of course, with the plant-based kind of movement going, it's really great that you're kind of on the ground, I suppose, so to speak, because, you know, if you think about the plant-based, like why have we based plant-based eating on certain populations? You literally work among those populations. So I guess I'll let you introduce yourself. Tell people, I guess, what you do and why and how you kind of got there.
Okay, sure. So I'll try and keep it brief. My story actually starts when I was super, super young. When I was about 4 or 5 years old, unfortunately, my father was diagnosed with cancer in his early 30s, which I can't even imagine what that would be like. I would totally date myself, but I just turned 30. And the last thing I could imagine is being diagnosed with cancer. But unfortunately, that's what happened with my dad. He did have traditional medical treatment in the form of chemotherapy. But as an adjuvant treatment or an aside, he actually completely overhauled his lifestyle on the advice of his primary care doctor. Because at that time, that was when the first kind of emerging research was coming out with the correlation between red meat and cancers of the colon and the rectum. And for the type of cancer my dad had, that is an extremely common secondary. And I actually only just found out recently, my dad actually had metastatic cancer, which I didn't know. He said he can't remember all of the details, but he thinks it was possibly liver, bone, maybe lung, as well as the primary, which for him was testicular cancer. So basically took to the library, read everything he could, find a lot of the, you know, the doctors that we know and love, some of the earlier pioneers, Nathan Pritikin, Dr. John McDougall, Caldwell Esselstyn, Dean Ornish, and the Adventist Health Studies, which will I will come back to you in a second because it's very relevant to my story. But basically, he went completely plant-based overnight. This is in the early 90s when it really wasn't that common. I know the only place we could find soy milk was in the Asian supermarkets. And, you know, the abundance of plant-based options in restaurants was simply not available. I don't think anyone really even knew what we meant when we said we were vegetarian. I remember going to restaurants and getting, you know, fish as the vegetarian option. And we were what was known as a strict vegetarian at that time, which would be more synonymous with plant-based or vegan these days. Mm-hmm. That terminology wasn't really used at the time, especially not where I was growing up in Perth, Western Australia. So we followed a very similar nutritional pattern. The closest I can relate it to would be Dr. John McDougall's starch solution. A lot of potatoes, a lot of rice, a lot of breads, all whole grain, free of salt, oil, and sugar. Quite a, I guess people would think it was a strict diet, but for me, that was totally normal. That's what I grew up on, raised that way, managed to grow into a full functioning adult, which is always reassuring to people wondering about their kids. So I've done it since I was about 4 years old. So where does that take me to today? So I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life most of my life. Nutrition was a big part of it. Always had a huge interest in nutrition. Was very interested in becoming a dietitian. But I was also probably more interested in dancing. I was interested in painting. I love fine arts. You know, when I remember when I was finishing high school, my mom had said to me, why don't you take the medical school entrance exams? And I was like, Mom, why would I do that? Like, why would I want to be a doctor? I have zero interest. I didn't take any biology, didn't take any human biology in high school, literally zero interest. Ended up going into journalism and found that I loved writing health articles. I loved reading about nutrition. I loved writing about it. And I'd gone into journalism because I'd failed to get into become a dietitian. So then I applied to be a dietitian again because I thought, wow, I can write articles as a dietitian. I failed again. And my third attempt to get into dietetics, I thought, you know what? There's a lot of doctors that I'm interviewing. I'm reading a lot of these doctors writing articles. Maybe I'll apply for medical school and then I can write articles as a doctor. And I got into medical school and I was like, well, you know, close enough. Everything happens for a reason. I'm going to run with it. I love all these plant-based doctors, so maybe I'll become one of those. So that's how I ended up in medical school. Some of it challenging, some of it good. As everyone knows, medical school is not something you just do for fun. It's quite intense, but fantastic learning opportunity. And now I am so grateful that it happened. I couldn't imagine doing anything else with my life. But going back to what you asked me, why, how did I end up in Loma Linda? Clearly from my accent, I'm Australian. I went to medical school in Australia. In my third year of medical school, I had some vacation time. Then I decided to go to the, PBNHC, the Plant-Based Nutritional Healthcare Conference. It was in Anaheim that year in California. And I went there and it was the first time in my medical career that I was in a room of, I think there was like 600 or 800 people that year that were all talking about plant-based nutrition, were all talking about nutrition as medicine, lifestyle medicine. A lot of the people that spoke there were people whose books I had known since I was a child. My absolute like health idols were all speaking there. And it really changed my life. It made me realize that this is a valid medical career. And probably the key changing talk for me in terms of my career was Dr. Alan Goldhammer spoke. He's from the True North Health Center in Santa Rosa, California. It is a medically supervised water fasting and whole food plant-based nutritional sort of healthcare rehabilitation center, almost for people, you know, almost desperate to get healthy. And I really was a little bit skeptical. It sounded dangerous to me. The results he was, you know, I was all about plant-based, but going without food for up to 40 days, you know, and then getting these crazy results. The one that stands out in my mind and I always talk about is their hypertension results. They were dropping blood pressure by 50 millimeters of mercury in people. That is something that I hadn't even been able to achieve with five different antihypertensive or blood pressure medications. That was so extreme to me that I really didn't believe it. And I remember sending him an email and I was like, I listened to your talk. I'm a little bit skeptical. I also kind of am a bit worried that it's dangerous. I've got an elective in medical school. Can I come and join you? And he said, yes. And so I ended up in True North for, I was an intern there for 6 weeks. And then I stayed for a further week with Dr. Michael Clapper, my absolute idol, just following him around, learning from him. And basically had just spent 8 weeks watching patients get well and seeing things that I never imagined was possible. You know, I knew that there were great benefits from lifestyle medicine, nutritional medicine, because I'd seen that in my own family. But just seeing it day after day, you know, disease after disease, condition after condition, problem after problem, just seeing all these people get well. I remember sitting down with Dr. Goldhammer and I said to him, I was like, I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to Australia. I don't want to finish medical school. This is what I want to do. This is what I want to practice. This is what I believe in. Like, you've changed my life. Can I have a job? And he was basically, if anyone's listened to Dr. Goldhammer, he's extremely blunt. He was like, don't be an idiot. You're going back to Australia. You're finishing medical school. You're far more valuable as an MD than you are as an ungraduated, you know, wannabe medical student. So I did go back and I finished, but he had said to me, have you heard of Loma Linda? And I was like, of course I've heard of Loma Linda. I'm obsessed with the Adventist health studies. I presented on the Adventist health studies in medical school. I know everything about them. He said to me, you know, you can do residency there. I was like, no, I'd never even thought about that. Like, it seems so silly now in hindsight, but I'd literally never looked into it. So I jumped straight on their website and I found their, they had two programs that interested me. One was family and preventive medicine and one was preventive medicine. And I was reading through these, and not only that, but Loma Linda has what they call a whole person care model, which means instead of just looking at someone as a bundle of diseases, you're looking at who are you as a person? What does your life look like? Where do you live? What is your culture? What is your spirituality? Who are you? Not what disease can I diagnose you with? So reading that and then reading the concept of preventive medicine, they also had a lifestyle medicine track, which was basically whole food, plant-based food, prescribing it to patients and seeing them get the well. The hospital is vegetarian. They have whole food, plant-based options. All the staff are on board. And I remember just sitting there and I was like, I have found my dream job. I called up Loma Linda. I spoke to the program director of preventive medicine at the time and was like, I need to be in your program. How do I get in your program? Long story short, went and visited them, did all the harsh reality of applying for residency in medical school, lots of exams, lots of money, lots of stress. And long story short, I ended up matching February the following year, and here we are.
Sounds amazing. It's good that you kind of made your dreams become a reality, which is like the key thing, I think, to come from that story. So for people that don't know Loma Linda, that's obviously one of the five blue zones, which obviously mm-hmm. has been researched quite heavily in the Blue Zones book. I also I find it really interesting, like the whole Blue Zones, because there's so many, you know, positives in those communities. Why did you, why is Loma Linda your favorite one out of, you know, there's also the other four, Greece, Japan, the other ones. So why is that your top and your favorite one?
So believe it or not, I actually also looked at residency in Japan because they have some lifestyle medicine programs, and I'm actually somewhat fluent in Japanese. I learned it through high school. I've been to Japan a couple of times and I thought, oh, that'll be great. And then I realized you had to take their board exams in Japanese. And whilst I can speak Japanese, I certainly can't read it at a medical level. So that kind of put that one out of the picture. But Loma Linda was definitely my number one. And the reason being is that is the Blue Zone and the Adventist health study population where it's probably the best evidence, to the best of my knowledge, that we have on a broad scale of the benefits of a plant-based nutritional eating pattern. All of the Blue Zones, all five of them, are considered plant-based or plant-forward, plant-progressive. The difference with the Adventist health population is they really have set up an ideal population to study the difference between health-conscious individuals with low intakes of animal products versus a large population of the same health-conscious individuals that are entirely plant-based, and to see the difference. And surprisingly, the differences are actually striking between the two. And that was what interested me, because obviously I was into, you know, ideally 100% whole food plant-based nutrition. And this is the closest population that we have to that. So that was my biggest motivation. And then the whole person care model was a big part of it as well.
Yeah. And I find that super interesting because the Blue Zones are, you know, your longest living populations in the world. And mm-hmm. Loma Linda, you have got examples of people that are fully vegan plus mm-hmm. examples of people that aren't. And I actually read, probably a study that you're probably very familiar with, is like, what's the difference between the people in the group of that do eat a little bit of meat and the ones that don't? How long do they live for? And when I saw that, I was like, holy crap, like this is the longest living population in the world, and the ones that don't eat meat even a small amount, you know, mm-hmm. are living longer. I was like, that's like I wouldn't say proof, but massive like backing of, this is why a plant-based diet is going to help you live the longest. This is why you know, preventing all these other chronic illnesses. Why would you not choose to live like this? If we look at the flip side of that, because of course, you know, there's always people like, oh, Blue Zones, blah, blah, blah. Do you think that if the other four completely cut out meat, they would have the similar kind of result? And is there any other populations that are living longer, or even close to living longer, that maybe include more meat in their diet?
So my understanding, when you look at the five Blue Zones, so the one in Sardinia, the one in Greece, the one in Costa Rica, the Adventist obviously in Japan, from my understanding, when you look at the research, the vegan or entirely plant-based Adventists are living a little longer. It was somewhere between 4 to 8 years compared to the other blue zones. So most blue zones are the places in the world that have the most centenarians or those living over 100. But when you look super closely at the data, the average blue zone gets about 10 years extra to the average population. And then when you look at the Loma Linda Adventists, they usually get an additional 4 to 8 years. And this is all in good health. I think that's the most important thing that people need to understand, because modern medicine is fantastic. I can keep pretty much anyone alive. We have people in comas for 10, 20 years. We can keep people alive. But what we talk about is the blunting of the aging curve. So instead of sort of your typical trajectory of aging, where you just kind of slowly decline as the years go on, we talk about squaring the curve. So living as long as possible in good health, and then getting to your maximum lifespan and kind of dying rapidly so that you don't suffer at the end of your life.
Yeah. Quality of life, right?
Yeah, what you were saying, do I think that if the other blue zones had decreased or eliminated meat? I think it really depends. And I've really become more open, I guess, in my approach, because what I've really found in medicine is so much of helping people is meeting them where they're at and getting them to move along the spectrum from where are you now in your sick and disease state, or just, you know, not ideal lifestyle habits, and how can we move you towards what we believe is optimal. And that for some people may mean including a little bit of meat. That may be a no-go zone for them. But other people, if you ask my honest opinion of how I think is optimal, it is moving as close to a whole food plant-based diet as possible. And I think the fact that the Adventists, if you look at the Adventist health studies, the ones consuming meat, they're still living a long and healthy life, but their animal product intake, it's about 4 to 5% of meat, and then about 10% of dairy products. That is significantly less than the general population. So if we can get everyone there and they live in good health to 90, that's amazing. But if you want that extra 4 to 8 years and you want to be more like, I'm going to live in good health to 100, that's where we have the evidence of the about 25% of the Adventist population that are considered entirely plant-based or very, very close to that. We just have the evidence. You know, there's 96,000 people in the Adventist health study too, and about 25% of them are completely plant-based. And we are seeing significant improvements always, you know, almost every single disease condition, health condition, inflammatory condition, weight, longevity, all of these aspects that we look at, we see a stepwise improvement the closer to completely plant-based these people are.
Yeah. And I think that is like crazy that you can like look at that and be like, this is the difference. So mm-hmm. for people that are listening, obviously it's clear and important to kind of distinguish between like being vegan and being whole food plant-based, because mm-hmm. you can't expect to live to 100 if you're vegan but still eat processed crap, mm-hmm. which is I think becoming more and more prevalent, especially in like these big like London, we're having so much processed vegan food. So what is the optimal kind of whole food plant-based diet that they should kind of be having to live that long? What's like the key elements?
Yeah, it's super interesting that you say that, because it is something that I do have a little bit of concern. So just like you say, for example, when my family went whole food plant-based, these vegan junk foods that we have were just simply not available, or if they were, they were in very, very small quantities and very expensive, and they just weren't part of your traditional plant-based diet. And the Adventist health study started back then. I think they started in the late 80s, early 90s, maybe even a little earlier, maybe the 70s. And the foods that they were eating were drastically different to the abundance of, you know, these vegan foods that we have available. I think it is important to keep in mind the Adventists in the studies do eat processed mock meats, but this is not a large percentage of the diet. But I believe that that was included as a small percentage of it. But like you say, going to what we have now, we simply don't have the scientific evidence. So when I'm talking from a medical perspective, we don't have the evidence of how does, say, a fake burger or vegan ice cream or vegan cakes and cookies. I don't think we really have the evidence that these are helpful products. If we're talking environmental and ethical, maybe, but I try and avoid those arguments when I'm talking medical, because I want peer-reviewed scientific literature, because you can't argue with that as much as, opinion. So I do have concern about that. I think that they can be good transitional foods for people. They can be good every other sort of, you know, maybe a treat food every now and then. I think we have to be mindful of going a bit too far and, you know, becoming obsessive with our diet, not having any enjoyment in our diet. But I think if we're looking at, you know, at least the 80-20 rule, I really do believe at least 80 to 95% of the diet should come from whole plant foods. And that's simply because if we look at all the large studies on nutrition, obviously the Adventist Health Study 1 and 2, we have the Epic Oxford from the UK. We have quite a few other ones. There's some coming out of like Thailand and other Asian countries looking at the Nurses' Health Study, the Physicians' Health Study, all of these big studies looking at nutritional patterns. And we really start to see the same common elements emerging that are also in the blue zones. We see so much evidence for whole grains, increasing the whole grains in the diet, so much evidence for legumes, increasing beans, chickpeas, split peas, all of those in the diet. We see so much evidence for fruits, vegetables, and there is a fair bit of evidence for nuts, seeds, and healthy plant fats. So I really think that the majority of your nutrition should be based upon that, because even though these foods that are coming out are minimizing animal products that we know is ideal, they're eliminating dairy, eliminating animal products, they still contain a lot of the foods that we have evidence isn't ideal. Processed carbohydrates, refined sugars, oils, and saturated fats. A lot of these have palm oil, they have coconut oil, and rammed into them, like a vegan cheese is basically coagulated saturated fat from an oil just because it's plant-based. I just don't think we have the evidence yet that these foods are healthy. And I think that as it starts to emerge, I think we will start to see that these really shouldn't be forming the base of our diet and we should be going back to a more traditional eating pattern.
Yeah, and I would agree. But at the same time, you did touch on an important point. You know, you still want to have a little bit of like food that makes you happy as well as your whole food as well.
Exactly. And I think that there has to be a nature of cultural sensitivity and patterns. And I think that you have to look at things as a big picture. Like I said, I really don't think that we have any evidence that if you have a piece of cake on your birthday or a big indulgence on Christmas dinner, that that's going to affect your health. And I think that the socialization of that, I read a book once that was called like, I think it was called Crying at Home Alone with Salad, and it was on orthorexia. Or I know some people don't like that term, but I think that there's something to be said for the cultural and family and social connections that we have around food. But just making sure that, I think it's Dr. John McDougall that said it, make sure that it isn't Easter for breakfast, Christmas for lunch, Thanksgiving for dinner, and your birthday for dessert every single night. I think that the bulk of the diet, whole food, plant-based, with, you know, allowance for life happens sometimes.
Yeah, sure. So you obviously mentioned whole grains and people, mm-hmm. you know, tend to have a little bit of a negative maybe thought about whole grains with the keto diet being so massive at the moment. And you also mentioned beans and legumes, which obviously contain lectins, which is also getting an interesting kind of view on things. So how can we kind of show people that, you know, carbs aren't bad? You can eat carbs and still live a long time and still lose weight and be a healthy weight. And lectins aren't bad either. Like, of course, you've got the evidence of the blue zones, but what else can we kind of say? Well, this has, you know, supporting the argument they should be included in your diet.
Yeah, I think I guess it's very hard to conceptualize where these ideas are even coming from. If we look, you know, for a very, very long part of our human history, depending what research you read, if you look at even like super ancient archaeological studies, it seems like we have been plant-based for a very long time. Even possibly for the entirety of our human evolution, it looks like we have been predominantly plant-based. And the majority of plant foods, especially those that are abundant year-round, and especially since the introduction of agriculture, these are high carbohydrate, high fiber, high starch foods. And we look at that all over the world, whether it's underground tubers being one, what we believe to be sort of the original human food source. When we had fire, we could cook these potatoes and that starch allowed us to evolve to be more modern humans. If we look at all the long-lived populations, you know, all over Asia and India with super high fertility rates, super booming populations, the staples are rice and not even whole grain rice a lot of the time. You know, we look at the Egyptian and evolving around that area, it's, you know, wheat, potatoes all over the UK and Europe. And we just see all these people thriving. You know, we didn't get to a population of how many billion are we at now? 8 billion, 9 billion. We didn't get there without consuming the bulk of our nutrition from carbohydrates. And until very recently, the human population was thriving. We did not have the rates of disease that we seem to have developed in the last 50 to 100 years. It just wasn't the case. I know that you didn't want to focus on the blue zones, but when you were talking about do carbohydrates cause weight gain, well, we can see that the only population in the Adventist Health Study that was a normal body mass index less than 25. I know there's a lot of argument about the validity of the body mass index, but it is one tool in the toolkit of medicine. The only people were the entirely plant-based eaters. They were the only ones with an average BMI under 25. What other evidence do we have for that? Every large epidemiological study that looks at nutrition really correlates whole grains, high carbohydrate intake, minimal intakes of fats, saturated fats, and meat products and dairy products. That's just what's associated with good health and longevity. So I think probably what comes with the appeal of eliminating carbohydrates and where this comes up with a lot of these kind of new trendy diets is the rapid weight loss. And we know if we look at any study on weight loss, what can be super motivating for people is rapid weight loss. And the average human can hold like 4 to 10 pounds or kilograms of glycogen. And when you eliminate carbohydrates, that very first week of your diet will have major diuresis or lots of loss of fluid. And the weight loss can be quite spectacular in the initial stages. However, this is simply a loss of glycogen. It isn't true fat loss, which is what the person is desiring. But I think that for some people that have been struggling with their weight for such a long time, to be able to be like, I've just lost 8 pounds in a week, that, you know, that makes them believe that this is something healthful. And the transition for most people on this planet, in westernized or more wealthy countries, are used to eating meat multiple times per day. So it's not really that much of a shift for them to change their nutrition. They're eating the foods they're familiar with. They're eating the, you know, the high calorie, high fat, pleasure trap type foods. And it's not that much of a shift to eliminate carbohydrates for a lot of people. And there's been so much press and media that they think it's a good idea. But to actually see this from a health perspective, we have zero evidence. The patients I've seen consistently do not have good health outcomes following these nutritional patterns, that I just cannot see anything beyond the initial weight loss. And even that is not sustainable. They will regain it all with the regain of glycogen. There's just no evidence that I have come across. And I'm more than happy for people to send it to me if they have any, but I just can't see it in clinical practice. I can't see it in peer-reviewed literature that there is any reason to eliminate these foods that consistently show up as health promoting. That is whole grains, beans and legumes, fruits and vegetables, and any nutritional pattern that eliminates these, I would be extremely cautious of.
It's a very good answer, because I think that also applies to like vegan keto, which seems to be a new kind of thing that's happening. And I think it's also important for people that are listening is that you can, you know, if someone goes on a keto diet and they lose weight, then sure, their blood sugar and their cholesterol is going to go down. But is that because of the keto, or is it because they've actually lost weight? So maybe you can share some insight of that as well.
Yeah. So the two issues I have with that, let's start with blood sugar. The biggest problem is you're really not addressing the problem. And so the precursor or the reasons that people have blood sugar problems as a precursor to type 2 diabetes mellitus is because of insulin resistance. And from the Mastering Diabetes program is great, PCRM with Dr. Neil Barnard, we really look at the underlying issue with insulin resistance being intramyocellular fat or fat in the muscles clogging up the insulin receptors, making the insulin not work. So by just removing the carbohydrates, sure, it looks good on paper because you don't need the insulin to pump the sugar into your muscle cells because there is none. You're not consuming it. So you don't have that problem. But are you addressing the underlying issue of the fat being in the cells, the insulin receptors not really working, not really responding to the insulin? Of course not. And these people that follow it because they're eating a high fat diet, they end up with more and more fat. They're not getting really the energy that their muscles prefer. The muscles prefer to run off glycogen and run off sugars. They're not getting that. So we consistently see in most studies on athletes reducing their carbohydrates, the exercise tolerance or exercise performance consistently goes down. So you can't exercise and be active and feel great. And then you're not addressing the root cause of the problem, the insulin resistance. We see on the flip side, and this is great for people that actually, it's interesting looking at those with type 1 diabetes that will forever need at least some form of insulin, but seeing the dramatic reductions that they need in insulin when they switch to a low-fat, whole food, plant-based diet. And also in patients that have type 2 diabetes, being able to come off their insulin because we fix the underlying insulin resistance that they no need to administer exogenous or external insulin anymore. Their blood sugar control increases, their hemoglobin A1C consistently goes down because they're addressing that problem by consuming a low-fat, whole food, plant-based diet and having to use up that intramyocellular fat as an energy source. They remove it from clogging up the receptors, insulin sensitivity goes through the roof, and their blood sugar control becomes extremely, extremely good on a high carbohydrate diet. The amount of carbohydrates they can consume without their blood sugar elevating consistently increases. Yeah. So the second part that you asked me, so you said diet, blood sugar control, and what was the other one? Sorry.
Cholesterol.
Cholesterol. So that's an interesting one because that is not one I see in clinical practice. So I definitely have a lot of patients coming to me. I worked at Kaiser for a while in their bariatric medicine department, and I consistently saw people that, you know, like you say, this ketogenic or low carbohydrate, because just to make a disclaimer, most of these people are not following a true ketogenic diet. They're following a high protein, high meat, high fat diet. That is not a ketogenic diet. The amount of protein in a ketogenic diet is usually 5 to 10% at most. And with the quantities of meat these people are consuming, that just isn't possible. But what I consistently see is elevated cholesterol, 300, 350, and going up and up and up. This idea that cholesterol goes down when consuming a ketogenic diet, I just have not seen in either a published clinical study or in clinical practice. I consistently see it going up and up and up. And if these people are motivated and willing to transition to a whole food plant-based diet, the cholesterol consistently goes down, almost always going at a very minimum below the normal of 200, but most of the time below what Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn calls heart attack proof, below 150 using the American numbers of measurement. And that just can't be argued with. We see it consistently, whole food plant-based, significantly lowers cholesterol in almost everyone.
Yeah, and it's kind of a shame because obviously these people are committing themselves to wanting to be healthier. And for whatever reason, they've chose probably something that's probably going to get them faster because of what, you know, social media or marketing has kind of told them. And unfortunately, it's just a misdirected effort. If we could get that effort towards, you know, what you're doing and what I'm doing, then that would be a much better long term for, you know, them and everybody around them, right? I want to talk more about the blue zones because, you know, the blue zones don't just live long because they have a plant-based diet. I'd say that, you know, there's other elements to why they live long. So maybe we could talk more about what else kind of makes them live longer, you know, like their whole spiritual kind of things, being sociable, what kind of exercise they're doing. And also I find quite interesting is a lot of the blue zones don't eat until they're full. So they're currently like, or always kind of in a, would you say that they're always in kind of like a calorie deficit, or is they just, they don't eat until they're full? And how much impact is that going to have on like life expectancy?
Sure. So I'll start with the full part so I don't forget it. So I've heard this quoted many, many times, especially referring to Japan. So I've been to Japan multiple times. I've actually been to Okinawa. Japanese people probably eat some of the biggest portions I have ever seen in my life. So I don't really know. I don't know if this was a traditional thing. Maybe I just missed it when I was there. Every time I ate with people, they were encouraging me to always have an extra 5 bowls of rice. So have I ever seen this? No. Do I actually believe this? Probably not. I think this was something that maybe came out. I am more than open to be corrected wrong, but that was definitely not the food behavior that I saw in Japan. What I think, however, if you're talking about a caloric deficit, I think that the thing with whole food plant-based and plant-based foods is there can sometimes be a relative caloric deficit, because the way that calories are counted is food is burned and then the energy is to raise the temperature of water by a certain amount of degrees. And that's how we determine the caloric content of food. Last time I checked, my stomach was not a furnace and our digestive tract certainly wasn't heating up water. That's not how we digest and process foods. So a lot of these fibers that are found in plant foods can burn and create heat, but we don't digest them and they go to feeding our microbiome, the amount of absorption, you know, what is the state of your gut? What is your microbiome doing? And I feel like there is this part, you know, there's definitely a lot of research coming out in the last, say, 5 years, but I think this is largely misunderstood. And I think that potentially what is happening is a lot of the calories in these foods are just not being absorbed. So on paper, it might look like you're consuming 2,500, 3,000, 3,500, but really what you're absorbing is probably significantly less than that. And that's the way the human body was designed. We have pretty big stomachs that want to stretch out, feel full, have lots and lots of energy, and then to have all these great substrates, these fibers, these short fatty acids to feed the bacteria that live in our gut and help us thrive and really function that way. I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, I have never seen people get healthier by intentionally limiting or ignoring their hunger. I think the body is extremely smart. I think we get hungry and full for a reason. It's just making sure that we put in the majority of the time the food that we know is the best for us, the whole grains, the legumes, the fruits and vegetables, and using those principles of caloric density. Barbara Rolls, I'm pretty sure she's from Penn State, has great research on this, basically showing that if you consume an ad libitum or as much as you like whole food plant-based diet, most people achieve and maintain their optimal weight and health. So I think that it's a lot more complicated than we want to reduce everything down to numbers and calories and macronutrients. I think there's a lot going on with plant-based foods that leads to that. Now, what was the first part of your question today?
Before you go into that next part, yeah. I think that's a really good answer because, like you said, calories are measured by heating water. That's not how our body breaks things down. And we do tend to oversimplify things like calorie deficit, blah, blah, blah. Fiber, I think, is also a massively overlooked. It's almost like the effort that people put on their protein intake should actually be transferred over to their fiber intake. And if more people did that, we'd probably see much better and healthier populations. The first part of the original question was, what other things are the blue zones doing that probably contribute to them living longer? So spiritually, what kind of exercise are they doing? I think they believe in a religion. They also spend lots of time with their family. So what kind of things kind of contribute?
Yeah, for sure. So that, I know the blue zones from Dan Buettner, they kind of have the power nine, and some of them, I don't 100% agree with because I'm more, towards the Adventist. So the one that I really don't like is wine at five. Most people don't realize alcohol is listed as a class one carcinogen. We know that alcohol causes cancer. So to encourage someone to consume alcohol on a daily basis, I just don't think that that's medically sound. I think my personal opinion, and people are more than welcome to disagree, I really think that the relaxation, the socialization, the deep breathing, all of those things that people often associate with the people that say have a glass of wine at the end of the day, I think that they're the things that are leading to longevity rather than the alcohol itself. But happy to be proven wrong. You know, people have done more study on this than I have. But from the Power Nine, ones that I really like are move naturally. So keeping physically active. And I definitely see that in Loma Linda where I live. Loma Linda is extremely hilly and I see people like in their 90s walking up these super steep hills, moving around. You know, so many people are in their garden. A big population of Loma Linda works at the hospital and everyone knows doctors are run off their feet all day. Doctors, nurses, personal trainers, physical therapists, everyone's running around the hospital. So I think there's a lot of natural movement, just day-to-day activity, a lot less just sitting at a desk. A lot of the places in Loma Linda where I work, we actually have standing desks. So just a lot of encouragement on being naturally physically active. the second one, the state of belonging. And that's where you come up with whether that's community, spirituality, but obviously Loma Linda being Adventist, there is a huge faith-based community. And it always surprises me how just everyone knows everyone and they all get together and connect and we pray together, pray with patience, and just having that sense of a shared belief system, shared belonging. And whether it's religious or not, I don't know if that makes a difference, but just having a community that you really belong to. Another one in the blue zones is having a sense of purpose. And I can definitely attribute this to my own life and people that I see, you know, even patients. I see that people that have a reason to get up in the morning tend to be healthier or tend to be more motivated to make things work. They tend to have that attitude where, you know, even if they are diagnosed with a disease, that they're like, this isn't me. I'm going to get through this because I have to, you know, volunteer at my church, or I'm running a soup kitchen, or I've got all my patients. And they just have something that they have to wake up to every day that gives you a reason to not be sick, to not fall into depression, to, you know, just have that value in your life. So I think those three are super important. Loved ones comes up, and that kind of goes back to what I was talking about, belonging, connecting. But Loma Linda definitely has family first, and that can be shown by their day of Sabbath. So Saturday, almost, you know, the hospital, of course, can't close down, but there is a big part that Saturday, where possible, from sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday is a day of rest. And most of the time that is spent with family, minimal technology, you know, not playing on your phones, just spending time. Old-fashioned game nights are popular. I've been invited to a lot of those at work. And, you know, just sitting down to a meal, having fun with your friends and family, playing games, chatting, and really getting back to that kind of old-fashioned connection before we went crazy with technology. Another one that they talk about, they call it downshift in the Power Nine, but this can be anything from meditation, relaxation, even just talking about the Sabbath, just having some downtime, reconnecting to what's important, slowing down, lowering your stress. And we see stress continually coming up in multiple studies. Dr. Dean Ornish is probably a great one, using meditation with cardiovascular disease. Just having that time to take a deep breath, relax the entire body system, you know, switch from this sympathetic go, 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 fight or flight mode to a parasympathetic, resting, digesting, being well. I think that's super, super important. They mentioned right tribe, which I think I've kind of already gone about, having a great sense of friends and people that share the same values of you. And that can be super important when you're trying to improve your health. Like, make your friends, where possible, health promoting friends. You know, if you are trying to improve your nutrition, but your friends want to go out and get bacon and eggs every day, it doesn't mean you can't be friends with them, but they're probably not going to help you along your journey. You know, instead of going and, you know, getting cake and coffee with a friend, find a friend that wants to go for a hike with you. People that really help your life, you know, having a friend that wants to go to church with you or go to yoga with you, and just having a tribe that really promotes your health. And then the last one is plant-based, that we were just been talking about the whole time. So I think that's kind of the main of the nine that really resonate with me in terms of what else makes the Blue Zones healthy beyond what they're putting on their plate.
Yeah. Which one do you think is the one that people should, or the top three that people should really be focusing on?
You know, I am all for meeting people where they're at. And I think the one that they should pick is the one that resonates with them most, because we know that they're all helpful. And I think moving in that way will also start to increase the others, because let's say you're becoming more mindful, more relaxed. Well, that might make you start to think about other things like, well, who are my friends? Are they contributing to my life? What is my purpose? What's going on my plate? How else can I improve my health? And I think they all just start to trigger each other, and it becomes this journey of health improvement. I don't think it really matters where you jump on the bandwagon, as long as you get on there at some point. Obviously my passion is nutrition, and I think that it becomes increasingly difficult to run away from a bad diet. But I think that that's all part of the journey for people. And, you know, if that doesn't resonate with you at all, well, let's do everything else first. Let's, you know, improve your groups, your connectivity, your purpose, your movement. Let's perfect all of those first, if you don't even want to talk about nutrition. And then once all that's done, if you're achieving your health goals, still eating the way you want to eat, well, so be it. But if you're still not at your health goals, maybe it's time to start then.
Yeah, I agree. Because surely nutrition must have such massive weight when it comes to your health.
Exactly. And I'm biased. Obviously, it's my passion. And I think that that's the first place that people should start. But I am mindful that not everyone shares that view. But if I had to say, I think that what you put on your plate is just so important, because if we are not well nourished, it makes everything else really difficult. You know, it can make it hard to sleep. It can make it hard to focus. You don't have a lot of energy, so it can be hard to live your purpose. If you're not eating well and not sleeping well and don't have a purpose, are you really going to move your body the way that it should? I just think that optimizing nutrition is a great place to start for those that feel ready to do that.
Yeah, for sure. So another question I wanted to kind of ask is a common kind of argument, maybe, is that positive correlation does not mean causation. So, you know, some people say that's only an observational study. It could be a number of different things, why those people live the longest or why those people don't have these cancers. So how can we kind of disprove or prove certain theories with, you know, scientific research? Because, of course, you know, you can be like, why are these people living longer? Is it because of their diet? Let's take a closer look and find out, because there is so many examples when it comes to human studies. It's very hard to do a controlled human study for so long and control every single little thing. It's probably the same with smoking or, you know, birth defects. It's very hard to be like, hey, we're going to try and give you cancer, do the study for 20 years, and who's going to put the hand up? So how can we kind of prove or disprove theories that are not just observational studies but more than that?
Exactly. And you're totally right. I don't know about you, but I'm not really ready to sign up to live in a metabolic ward for the next 50 years. No, thank you. So nutrition is extremely hard to study. And like you say, it can be extremely hard with confounding factors. I think that's one of the reasons that drew me to the Adventist health studies, is because regardless of whether they consumed animal products or not, most people don't drink alcohol, most people don't smoke, most exercise regularly, and most are considered health conscious. So that takes out a lot of confounding factors. So, and the fact that this study has been, you know, the Adventist Health Study 2 has nearly 100,000 participants. It's been going for over 10 years. At what point do we start to say correlation is causation? It's, you know, a lot of the results coming out of the Adventist Health Study is replicated in the Epic Oxford Study, the Nurses Health Study, the Physician Studies, a lot of the ones coming out of Asia and Europe that I mentioned before. If we start getting the same results in multiple different countries, it starts to add a bit of weight of it. Does it cause it? No. But then, you know, at what point does it seem not viable anymore? If something is reproducible, that adds a lot of weight to it. And then we are starting to have a few more randomized control trial studies. Of course, they're not lifelong. But when we start to see things, so the main ones that come to mind for me is Dr. Dean Ornish, when we start to see things like reversal of heart disease, Dr. Luke Wilson's broad study where, you know, as far as it seems to be, the greatest weight loss ever published without mandating exercise or caloric restriction. If we can make these changes in people in less than a year, like literally reversing diseases, well, that adds weight to the fact that these large correlation studies are showing prevention of disease. So we have studies very strongly suggesting certain nutritional patterns are preventive. Then we show randomized controlled trials showing either improved management or reversal. Same with a lot of the studies from Dr. Neil Barnard reversing type 2 diabetes. It really just starts to add weight and the evidence starts accumulating on top and on top. And then for someone like me that is in the luxury where I can see people, work with them on dietary changes and test their labs and see reversal of disease, that just adds another layer for me. And so, of course, it will never meet any, criteria in epidemiology for being causation, but the evidence really does start to stack up in the right direction.
Yeah. And I think the flip side of that as well is like, if you can increase your odds of living longer and not getting cancer, even though it may not cause it, would you not try to live like the longest living populations? Because it's going to increase the risk of you also living, increase the risk, increase the likelihood rather of you also living just as long. Like, for example, yes, you know, red meat, like people can always argue it's not as bad as smoking. Why is it still in a class 1 carcinogenic? But at the same time, like, why would you take the risk with your own health or your family just because you don't believe somebody saying that it should be a carcinogenic or something like that? Okay, I do have more questions. You obviously were a moderator at nutritionfacts.org, which is working with Dr. Greger, and obviously he published How Not to Die, which I think most vegans and plant-based people know that book. How was that kind of in your career? Like, there's a lot of, I think some people love Dr. Greger, some people not so much. So how was that
for you in terms of moderation? Because, you know, he does those videos of this and that. How'd that kind of impact your overall career and way of thought, I guess?
For sure. So my moderation career at nutritionfacts.org is what I like to call my savior of sanity throughout medical school. So for me, I used to moderate for about 4 hours once a week. So not a huge time commitment, but in medical school, that felt like a ginormous time commitment. But the reason that I did it was because it was a weekly reminder to me of the evidence. It kept me on top of everything. So throughout medical school, and honestly, probably still today, I read every single study published in a peer-reviewed nutritional journal, on nutrition in the English language, and honestly, in most other languages using translator. I read every single article. So that kept me up to date with the literature. It kept me aware of what was going on, what the power of food could do. So that was really, really great for me, growing my education in terms of what, the power of food as medicine. It also helped me with being able to interact with the public. What questions are people asking? What are the challenges people are having? So it really prepared me to go into clinical practice when I finished medical school to kind of anticipate what are these questions, and it helped me learn how to answer them and how to help people. And, you know, I honestly really, really enjoyed it. I would still be doing it today if residency wasn't even more of a time commitment than medical school was. It was actually kind of crazy. I ran into one of the girls on the weekend that I'd never met before, that I'd spoken to regularly throughout medical school. She works for Dr. Greger. And it was just nice to reconnect, and it reminded me how much I miss it. As you say, you know, love him or hate him, I think that Dr. Michael Greger is doing fantastic. I refer a lot of my patients to his videos. They are just the ability that he has to translate scientific studies into something that's totally understandable and enjoyable to watch and easily applicable to your own life is just phenomenal. I think he's a very unique and successful individual. I know that you can, occasionally there's been studies where I've kind of read the whole study and I'm like, oh, maybe that was a little bit of a jump to the conclusion, but I think that we're all prone to that. And I think that truthfully, I would say at least 95% or more of his is very factual with very little opinion into it. And I think that that requires some respect and not to focus on maybe the 1 or 2% that was a little bit of a stretch. I think that that's the tendency that humans do. We want to poke and find the wrong things that everyone's doing. You know, even when you talk about these nutritional patterns that maybe we don't agree with at all, say ketogenic, high meat, if you take a step back and look at the big picture, a lot of the things that they're saying, you know, eliminate processed food, eliminate refined sugars, eliminate dairy products, a lot of these things, we all fundamentally agree to some extent on what good nutrition is. And I think that people want to focus and nitpick so that it's easier just to say, oh, it's too hard to understand nutrition, I'm just going to eat whatever I want. And I think that's my real thing, is trying to be positive about everything and work with people and make it a positive thing of how can you improve your life rather than trying to focus on like the very small negatives that come up.
Yeah. In New Zealand, we call it tall poppy syndrome, which basically means you just nitpick at the little things just because successful people were massively successful. And then there's all this good stuff going on, but somehow we still focus on the tiny little things that aren't massive, I suppose.
Exactly. Like you'll hear it in the plant-based communities, whether should I eat nuts or not? And it's like people have a meltdown. It's like, it just seems so crazy. And then it's like, well, no, none of the doctors agree. And it's like, hold on a second. Like we're talking about one food here. Oh, I don't know. I just think that it's very easy to get hyped up and focused on the, you know, focusing in on the micros and really, you know, what do they say? Focusing, miss the forest for the trees. I'm so bad at these sayings. I'm not even going to try. But you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, basically focusing on the small things and not the big things. So moderating studies is quite obviously quite interesting because, you know, a lot of people will just read a study and just because it's a study, they're like, oh, this must mean that it's true. Mm. But, you know, there's quite bad design studies out there. You know, like, for example, you can see some diets or maybe some studies that say, you know, red meat doesn't cause an increase in cholesterol. Because when we took it out, you know, it was still the same level. Mm-hmm. But I think also in that situation, it's like, what did they replace that red meat with in that diet? Mm-hmm. So how do normal people that aren't kind of researchers, moderators, that kind of stuff, how can they tell the difference between an actual study that is showing a true result versus one that is being designed to maybe show a favorable result, like by whoever funded it, or just one that was just a crap study?
Yeah, it can be really challenging. And I was actually just talking about this on Luke Tan's Plant Fit Summit that's coming up the other day. We spent quite a bit of time talking about research. And the thing is, it can be a real challenge. My entire first year of medical school, I had a full day of epidemiology and biostats every single week, just learning on how to interpret studies, learning all these words that they use. You know, if you look at any study, it's a ton of acronyms and letters, you know, risk ratio, odds ratio, relative risk, number needed to harm, number needed to trait, positive predictive value, negative predictive value. And it's like, what on earth does any of this mean? So that can be a real challenge to then interpret that without that kind of level of training. And then, as you'd mentioned, one of the things I mentioned is always scrolling to the bottom, looking at funding disclosures, who is supporting this. We end up with a lot of publication bias these days because no one wants to publish the same old thing over and over. You're much more likely to get published if you find something new or novel. An example I often give is, could you imagine if a journal published like, oh, week one of January, did you know that broccoli is good for you? Week two of January, we've got a new study, broccoli is good for you. No journal is going to do that. No journal is going to sell if they consistently publish the same evidence. So people are pushed to try and find new things. And, you know, without any malicious intent or harm intended, there is an awful lot of studies that are designed to prove a certain result. And that's exactly what you're saying. And it can be very challenging to pick that out. And I think that the way that you explained it is fantastic. And I use this when anyone asks me about anything. They'll say, what do you think of, you know, whole grains? What do you think of the keto diet? What do you think of rice? And it's like, well, who are we talking about? Compared to what? Like, what are they currently doing and what are their goals and what do they want to achieve and how does it make them feel? And it can be super difficult to figure that out because, like you say, if we take someone eating the standard American or the standard Australian or a high junk food diet and we transition them to, say, a different diet to what we promote that is still high in much more nutritious foods than what they were eating, of course they're going to get better results. If we compare, say, lean red meat to a high quantity of eggs, for example, you may see cholesterol go down. Does that mean that red meat makes your cholesterol go down? Of course not, but it's better than eggs. You know, we saw that emerge with the butter is back. Well, no, all it really showed is butter is maybe slightly better than processed margarines and some other horrible foods. If we compared butter to, you know, broccoli, I guarantee it's not going to show healthier results. So a lot of it is really compared to what are they doing? What other confounding factors, as you mentioned, what are they throwing in? I remember there's a study on eggs and cholesterol where they served the eggs on an oatmeal bun. Now we know oatmeal drives down cholesterol. So of course you're going to negate some of the implications of the high cholesterol content of the egg if you combined it with oatmeal. That's not a fair study. That's a confounding factor. So to answer your question, long story short, how to interpret a study, very difficult without a lot of research into the understanding how studies are designed, reading into it. I definitely encourage people, the more you read, the more you'll start to see patterns, the more you'll start to understand. I know Dr. Greger put out a webinar, I think it was a couple of hours of webinar. I can't remember if it's paid or not because I had access to it as a moderator. He actually put out a webinar on how to interpret studies and I'd highly recommend that for anyone wanting to know more. Otherwise, if that's not your jam, finding someone that seems to have a good level of understanding of clinical research and perhaps investing time or getting coaching or something from them or learning from the way that they distill information and just finding someone that you trust and that the information resonates with you.
Yeah, I think it's good advice is finding someone that you trust that is doing it for you because, you know, you can't do everything, especially when you've got jobs and families and that kind of stuff. So finding someone that you trust and make sure that they're doing. And I think also maybe getting it from more than one source, you know, like you said, if there's multiple studies saying the same thing and there's a population that's doing that stuff and is living long, then that's probably something you should listen to. With that being said, I think that is everything for this episode.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think that was really, really interesting. Thank you so much. I was very excited to have you on. That's why I worked so hard to get you on. It would take a while.
I'm so sorry.
It's good. It's good that you're finally here. And it's you know, the Blue Zones and the Blue Zone book and all that research is, you know, really interesting. And I feel like for anyone that hasn't researched or doesn't know what the Blue Zones are, they should definitely read up on it. Because I think it's really important that we do, you know, try and move as much as possible towards that kind of life. So with that being said, thank you so much for taking the time to record this podcast.
No, thank you so much. And thank you for inviting me. I'm always surprised that people want to listen to me talk, but I totally appreciate it. Very flattered and honored to be here. Very humbled. Thank you so much. You're doing great work. Keep it up and pleasure to be a part of it. Just keep, every single person that I meet spreading, like-minded messages. It just really makes me excited in my life. I'm not the only crazy person out there anymore.
No, I think it's right. It's good to see the world change around you rather than, change for the better around you rather than the opposite.
I could not agree more.
And that's all for today, guys. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Of course, we'll see you next week. If you have questions or want to find out more information about working with me, check out my Instagram at @thevegan_coach, my website, thevegancoach.org, or just check out my Facebook page. Have a great day and see you next week.